Well, welcome to Mount Olympus of American Literature, and we have the privilege of talking with one of the reigning gods, T.C. Boyle. Welcome.
Thanks, Dennis.
Is this book, Stories 2, is this a milestone book for you? Does it represent something maybe a little extra from any other book? Are you putting your house in order, or, you know, by publishing these stories in a collection?
It has a kind of valedictory tang to it, I suppose, but I'm feeling pretty good. You know, maybe there'll be a third volume of collected stories someday. I don't know. But I felt the time had come to collect everything since 1998. So it's a mere 915 pages. If I'd waited till the next collection, it would have been 1,200 pages. I mean, you should have seen the postman when he brought my 20 copies from England. The English book, incidentally, is about an inch thicker. They use thicker paper. The poor guy, I mean, he had a hernia just getting the books through the gate.
You seem to me like someone like Brahms, who doesn't like to repeat himself, has a large body of work, but is pretty selective about what he puts out. Are there stories that are unpublished stories sitting around somewhere?
No, there aren't. I've been asked this before, particularly from students who are trying to sort out where they're going to go with their own work. In the beginning, when I was only a story writer, I published probably 30 stories when I was a grad student. I collected 17 of them for my first book, Descent of Man. The others I kind of consider juvenilia. Since then, though, almost everything I've written has been collected. I've got to the self-editing stage where if a story is not working in a page or two, I know that and I will discard it, rather than previously when I'd write the entire story and then look at it and think, well, this isn't so great. So there are no unpublished ones. This collects everything I've done since 98, when T.C. Boyle Stories 1 came out.
So having become a more mature writer, you know when you're on the wrong track much sooner.
I hope so. Yeah, I think so. I'm very happy with the stories that I've put into these four volumes that are collected here, including, by the way, I should point out, the fourth section of this book, A Death in Kitchewank, is an entirely new volume of stories, of 14 new stories that I've published since Wild Child, which came out in 2010.
You so often write about losers. Are they more interesting, or are we all losers at one time or another?
You know what? I'll have to say yes to both of those things, both of those propositions. One of the joys of fiction, of course, is it can take us places where we don't want to go in real life. And I suppose we are all losers in some way, because as Samuel Beckett would have told us if he were sitting here, everything is pretty useless when you consider what the end of human life is. On the other hand, we like to think of ourselves as winners if we have a if we're lucky enough to have something to do in life that we really love. And so maybe I write about some of these figures who you call losers as a way of reminding myself not to go there, that work is important and that I love what I'm doing.
Some of what you say sounds like the T.C. Boyle of many, many years ago, but your writing, I think, over the years has become more intimate. You're dealing more with very subtle emotions, more intimate details about individuals. There's certainly still that large swath of irony that runs through your work, but it's becoming, as I say, more intimate. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I like that assessment. Early on in my career, when I was writing all these wild stories and water music and budding prospects and things flying off the walls, people would say, well, you know, I gotta wait till he matures. I guess now I finally have matured, Dennis. Incidentally, I broke my leg 2 years ago in a freak accident. Not a bad break, but just a little fracture. And so I had to sit around for a while, bored. And I realized, gee, I've broken my leg. Now I guess I'm mature. And so exclusively to that point, I had drunk white wine. Now I only drink red wine because now I'm mature.
The break in the leg, is that was the last piece in the puzzle?
It was.
I haven't done that yet. I'm not sure I want to follow
that. I don't recommend it.
Your first-person personas are so diverse. I remember you saying before that you feel that you can inhabit anyone for the purpose of writing the story. Can you talk about what's involved in that? It sounds sort of voodoo.
Yeah, well, the whole process, as I've often said, is a kind of voodoo. It's a kind of magic. It's why we love it as readers and writers, to enter into this unconscious world. The reader is entering the same world on his or her end that the writer is on his end. Absolutely. It's as simple as this. The stories just happen. I find an idea, I find a first line, and it goes. Whether it's going to be a first or third person narrative, it just suggests itself. I don't agonize over these things. It just happens. And as far as inhabiting different characters is concerned, that comes to me too. For instance, there's a story in here called What Separates Us from the Animals, one of the new stories. It's told from the persona of a busybody woman on a little island off of Maine, in which they have given a house to a doctor. They have to have an MD on the island and paid a stipend to the doctor to live on the island. And this woman is the busybody who lives across the street. And this doctor is okay as far as things go. He's there, he's present, but he's really messy. He really trashes that house that they've given him, and this woman is right on top of it. And so I just created a female busybody. I don't know how or why, I guess, from experience of such types.
You still have to find the voice of that woman. Does that just come to you, or is that the most difficult part of writing a story like that?
It just comes to me. The most difficult part is discovering what the story's about, and this doesn't usually happen until I'm well into it, to find out where is this going and what does it mean. This is true of the novels too, which is why I love to be a fiction writer, an artist, because it's just a joy to be able to shake things loose and see where they go, to make a discovery. You know, the professorial dictum has always been, write what you know. Well, maybe. Some writers are like this. I say, though, personally, write what you don't know and find something out. So, for instance, there's a story here called Swept Away, one of my favorites. It's a kind of tall tale. And I discovered that the Shetland Islands is the windiest place on Earth. So I just wondered for a while, what would that be like? And I wrote a little love story set in the Shetland Islands. I'd never been to the Shetland Islands. But after the story appeared in The New Yorker, the magazine of the islands, The Shetlander, came to me. They asked me, when did you live here? And I had to admit I never had, but they didn't care. They reprinted the story in The Shetlander anyway. I mean, this is the magic of fiction.
The story, which I cannot pronounce,
Chicxulub.
It was personally a powerful story for me, having had children in the ER. I think I know the answer to this, but did you live that experience, or did you know someone nearby, or were you a witness to this? The reason why I'm asking is that a demanding reader might ask, what has given you the right to write a story like this, which is so devastating to somebody like me, who can certainly feel what that is all about?
It's a very powerful story. It's the first one that I began to read in public that is not comedic. And I can feel the spell that this story casts over an audience.
Oh, it's
there's
terrible.
A point of reading this story aloud to an audience in which no one moves, no one coughs, no chairs squeak. It's a riveting story about a couple called in the middle of the night. Their daughter has been run over by a car, and they've got to go to the hospital, and there she is, dead. How do you deal with this? I have not had this personal experience. It's fiction. However, when I had first written that story and was reading it in public, I was on a book tour, and I read it to a fairly small audience in a bookshop in Miami, maybe 50 people. It was dark. We were all intimately in there. And about a third of the way through, a woman began to sob, and we could all hear her. We were all intimate. She sobbed throughout the entire story. And I wanted to stop and say, it's only fiction. It's make-believe. She had lived the story, and I hadn't, just as you had lived the story, you know? But that's why I'm so dedicated to stories and why they can move us and change us so much. I know about tragedy. Maybe I hadn't been the person in that room, but I do have a daughter. And once you do have children, the whole world opens up in a different and more frightening way. So that's where I'm coming from with a story like that.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel when you heard the woman sobbing?
I have to admit, I felt good.
Mm-hmm.
I felt good
really,
because the story was having an influence. I mean, I don't want to open wounds of some stranger, but of course, anytime you create a story and put it out in the world, you don't know how it's going to affect people.
When you're writing in third person, I get the sense that, oh, well, now this must be the voice of T.C. Boyle. And there's a certain consistency in some of the third person stories. And then we get to a story like In the Zone, which is the story about the recently cleared the Russian contamination area. I guess it's in Russia.
In the zone of alienation, yes, near Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds like someone else completely. And you've gone to some real lengths to give the feeling of these two principal characters and their language, and it's not T.C. Boyle anymore.
Mm. It's a question of point of view, and entering into the point of view, whether it's going to be first person or, in this case, third person, mm-hmm. a deep point of view of these people. Could I write from the point of view of an elderly Russian woman and her cohort, the man? I was fascinated. You know, I write so much about ecology. I'm fascinated by the way we animals, we Homo sapiens, deal with the rest of the world. And so, the zone of alienation is a place around Chernobyl after the power plant went up there in the 80s, in which no one was allowed to enter. And as a result, even though there's radiation in the ground, it's become a sort of natural preserve. Wolves have returned, eagles, all these creatures that had been disappeared had come back. And I learned that 3 years later, in 89, the government allowed peasants who had lived there in their own little homes and farmers to come back, despite the risks, if they were older than 50, because they would die anyway. And so I just wondered about this. It's a kind of paradise to go back here and live amongst these animals. And yet, it's a tainted and polluted paradise, a deadly paradise. So that kind of fascinated me. And in order to write it, I had to channel this Russian woman who is the one who goes back. Some authors, story writers, seem to have one mode of storytelling, and the stories can be quite good, but they lose force, I think, over the course of a longer book because they are similar in approach. They often have the similar character. I try to shake that up and do something different just to keep myself interested.
Mm-hmm. I say you don't repeat yourself, but there is a situation in your stories that does recur a few times, and that is that there's a moment when there's a man who's with a woman, and the woman goes off with another man. I'm thinking of Burnham Wood, mm-hmm. and of course the story about the man who was given a pornographic video of his wife before they were married.
The Way You Look Tonight.
Anyway, this situation comes up. Why so? Are you particularly obsessed with this particular emotion, or why does that keep happening?
Burnham Wood is the last story in the collection.
I read that in magazine form as well.
Yes, it was in The New Yorker, I think, last year or the year before.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to end because I like the way it ends on this quiet note and a gesture that brings you back into the story and wonder about the emotions of it. It's about a young couple, sort of like I was with my wife, wondering about the constraints of a relationship and how you can embrace it or break out of it or become restless with it. And the narrator isn't valuing her fully. And the consequence is another guy enters the picture. And what will happen? Well, we don't know. And as far as the previous story is, I was wondering about the fact that everything we do today, every breath we take is on film. And so what happens is a film pops up. This guy is a teacher and he's in the lounge and his brother sends him a text and a video. And it shows his wife having sex with a guy. And he obsesses over this. He looks at it. He realizes that this was her in college, long before he'd even met her. And yet, it's a kind of violation in the way that, you know, a story of a past lover isn't. Or even a photograph of a past lover. Here it is in living color and in the flesh. How would you deal with this? It's always kind of a what if. What if this was me? I should say, by the way, that I'm the only writer in American history only to have one wife. So these are all imaginative journeys. This, thank God, did not happen to me. Or not yet.
Let me ask you a little broader question. Fiction writing has played so many different roles in society. It's been the window to the world. It's been the window to the soul. But now that the world has exploded and everything is available to everyone, how is fiction writing changing? Is it diminishing or is it taking on a different role, do you think?
I can't predict. I can't say exactly. I know that my students at USC are as eager to make fiction as I was at their age, and as talented and is dedicated. I don't know what their place will be. Obviously, you're referring to the fact that people read fewer books, although, of course, we have e-books as well, which have allowed people who previously didn't read to read more. I really don't know. I would say this, though. Because the society is so busy and we're all so tuned in all the time and hooked up electronically, I think we're losing the idea of contemplative time. In order to read fiction, you have to have, to read one of these stories, you have to have half an hour of contemplative time. I try in my own life to purposely make contemplative time. I spend 6 months a year up in the Sequoia National Forest in a little house up there. Whether I'm there or I'm at home, I work on a computer, I run my business through email, etc. I don't obsess over it. When the day is done by 2 or 3 in the afternoon, I unplug. I don't care who is trying to get hold of me. I don't turn my phone on. I don't look at emails. I'll do that tomorrow. And for today, the day is over. I will go take a hike, go in the woods with a dog and a book. I'm waiting for rain here in Southern California so I can lie in front of the fireplace with a book, music playing, the oldest cat in the universe perched on my chest. She's now, I think, 20. And this is contemplative time. This is a time when you can use your own brain to create a scenario in your head from reading something rather than have it fed to you on a screen. But I guess, sadly, people are not willing to unplug. They don't have an experience of it.
As you look back on the obstacles that you faced early on in your career, what do you think? Do you regret those, or are you proud you overcame them? Like many writers, you had to go through a tough time to get published. What do you feel about that, those early times?
I regret nothing. I'm perfectly happy. I've had a long and productive career, which I hope continues to go on. As you can see, Dennis, I still have a few hairs left and most of my teeth. I think I'm doing okay. I don't really have any regrets. We talked earlier about John Updike, one of my heroes, who published his first volume of collected stories shortly before he died, and he wrote a preface too. And in it, he pointed out that he couldn't help rewriting his early stories for this book. I wouldn't do that. I don't want to sound complacent. I'm not. I have worked on these stories to the peak of my ability. They exist in their time as historical artifacts. This is a document. This is a kind of summing up of all the stories I've written so far. So I wouldn't want to change them. I'm happy with the way they've gone. And so too, yeah, sure, we all want to go out and conquer the world with our first book. But actually, it's been good that my career has gradually built over the years. I'm an artist. I never thought about making money. I'm just doing this. I do it anyway. But gradually, as I began to need money, that is, having three children, you know, who need braces on their teeth, etc., my audience came along with me, and all has been really kind of wonderful all the way along. I should introduce this story. This is a story that takes place up in the Sequoia National Forest, where I spend a lot of time, and I had heard that the Sierra Club, leading a hike of 60 and over, had a small contretemps, and two people got lost and spent the night up there together. The narrator is the guy leading the hike, and he is in his 60s. Hiking wasn't a competitive activity, or that was the party line anyway, but of course it was. It was about endurance, about knowledge, wisdom, woodcraft, and it was as testosterone-fueled as any other sport, which was why he liked leading the 60 and up groups. It eliminated the young studs with their calf-length shorts and condescending attitudes, the kind who were always pressing to pass you on the trail. He could really get worked up about that if he let himself, because the first rule of the group hike, to which they'd all sworn allegiance beforehand, was never to pass the leader, or for their opposite number, the bloated ex-athletes and desk jockeys and their top-heavy wives, never to lag behind the rear leader. Now, as they stood assembled at the trailhead, he went over the printed rules for the 12 hikers who'd showed up. Four couples in their early to late 60s, a single man wearing lace-up knee boots who looked to be 75 or so, and three stocky women in matching pastel hoodies he took to be widows or divorcees. "And remember," he said, "always keep in sight of the person ahead of you in case there's forks in the trails and you're not sure which way to go. Any questions?" My pain is worse than your pain. I like my wife fine, and we had a pretty smooth run of it over the years, but there was a sort of, what do I want to say here, expectedness to the days that sometimes bore down on me till I felt like a piece of furniture that hasn't been moved in a lifetime. An end table, maybe, made of maple, with some fine beveling that serves no other purpose than to collect dust. Which is why, and I'm not making excuses, just stating the facts, I pulled on my black jeans and turtleneck that night, dug my ski mask out of the closet, and climbed up the backside of Lily Barron's cabin to the patch of roof where the deck projects on the second floor, and peeped in the window with no other intention but to see what she was doing at 11:45 at night, and maybe, if that was what she wanted, to surprise her, give her a little jolt, in the best possible sense, that is, by way of amiability and with the promise of mutual enjoyment.